from 1980 to 1982. I'm thrilled to be back on campus. I can't describe how important CFRC was to me, not only as a training ground, it helped me develop my confidence in public speaking, and as far as my love of music, it was developed directly from this station. The wealth of records back then, we didn't even have CDs, and the people, the terrific volunteers that were here, I want to thank CFRC, and I'm really pleased, and I'm amazed at the technology that's here, and I'm wishing you all the best of success. This is Jean Legault for CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m., and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Last weekend, the Kingston Walk to End ALS managed to raise over double their original fundraising goal, while also hitting all-time records in both funds raised and attendance. Each June, which also happens to be ALS Awareness Month, communities across the country participate in the Walk to End ALS, organized by the ALS Society of Canada, showing support for the nearly 4,000 Canadians currently living with ALS. The original fundraising goal set for Kingston's walk was $45,000. Before the end of the day, they had already raised more than double that and hit a new all-time record, with the grand total being $117,752. Sarah Reedman with the ALS Society of Canada, who organized the Kingston chapter of the walk, shared her thoughts on the accomplishment.
It was phenomenal. Even going into that day, I was sort of re-clicking every minute of every day just to see where we were going. And for me, it just, it felt wonderful because the pressure's off me a little bit. So, to reach goal, but it did, you know, and it is a big push towards the bigger goal, and we're getting there. So it was wonderful.
Nearly 300 attendees took part, including new teams that made a big impact right out the gate and returning teams that gave it their all.
So this year we did have one big family that came out. So we had a newly diagnosed lady whose team and family and friends really got behind her. And their fundraising goal, from my understanding, to start with was 5,000. Then they'd crushed that, so they increased it to 20,000. And then they just absolutely crushed it. So we did have a couple of new teams on board this year, that team being one of them, and then another lady joined, and her team crushed it as well. So, and you know what, each walk goes in ebbs and flows. Some years we just have a big turnout, and other years not so much. It really depends what's going on in that person's life, and you know, other things come up in the meantime, right? So some people end up coming for a few years, taking a break, coming back. But really the biggest thing is, it's when somebody is diagnosed, this is their family and friends' way of showing their love and support for them. It's how I got involved in the first place with the ALS Society, actually, was joining a walk.
According to Reedman, the historic totals directly reflect the energy on the day.
The energy was fantastic. And you could just tell that people were so enthusiastic because they were showing up early. Registration starts at 10. People were showing up at 9:30. They were itching to go. It was wonderful to see. And I think as well, with one team being so big, and in fact, the another team was sort of fairly big as well, the energy was fantastic. The weather was great. That makes a difference as well. The location is perfect. The route along the lake there. And we tried to keep it upbeat, right? It's a coming together of the community. So we try to make it a positive event because it is a positive event. And although we know what we're there for, supporting it, the idea is for everybody to come together and celebrate together and just be part of that community. So the energy was fantastic. Since 2003, I think this final year now, we have pushed over $1 million that's been raised throughout the years through the Kingston Walk. So that, you know, Kingston's a very It's a very powerful community. It's a wonderful community. And there's a lot of loyalty, which is lovely to see.
The community's generosity was especially impressive in a time when fundraising isn't always easy.
We really do appreciate and recognize how much people put themselves out to ask people to donate to their cause, because there's a lot of causes, right? There's a lot of people have a lot of particular love towards a certain cause. And in this economical climate as well, the fact that people are still willing to put themselves out and say, hey, listen, I know times are hard for a lot of people, but would you support my fundraising initiative? And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see. We're so grateful. Honestly, we really are.
Every dollar raised will go directly towards research and supporting those living with ALS.
The donations are typically that come in are 50% goes towards research and 50% goes directly to supporting people living with ALS. So I'm a community lead. So my role is to provide resources and support for people living with ALS in the Central East and Southeast region. So Kingston being in the Southeast region. So I have a caseload of people and families living with ALS. My role is to visit them in their homes, make referrals to community health partners. I work really collaboratively with the ALS clinic in Kingston, and as well Sunnybrook, because that's in my area. So a lot of direct support. I facilitate support groups. Our organization has a support group program. We also have an equipment loan program. So anybody that needs mobility equipment in their home, we can provide that for them. So, and it doesn't cost them anything. So it goes towards a lot of that. And then as well, 50% goes towards research into therapies and treatments.
Looking ahead, the ALS Society of Canada is already preparing for next year's walk.
Same place next year. It's an annual event, but it is just a lovely community event. We would love to have anybody that would like to volunteer if they're not necessarily comfortable with raising funds and putting in a team. Volunteers are the heart and soul of our events. We could not do it without volunteers. So if anybody, they can just connect with me ahead of next year's event, and that would be amazing.
To learn more, donate, or get involved in next year's walk, visit the ALS Society of Canada website. The city is making progress on a number of initiatives to protect residents from extreme heat. On February 4th, 2025, Council passed a motion to get the ball rolling on several initiatives geared towards preparing the city for rising temperatures, including setting a maximum temperature for residential rental units and creating a heat response plan. At their Tuesday night meeting, the city's Environment, Infrastructure, and Transportation Policies Committee took a look at the completed community heat response plan, created in collaboration with the Southeast Health Unit. Kingston is experiencing more frequent and intense heat events. According to the plan, by 2050, the number of days over 30 degrees Celsius is projected to rise from 6 to 22 annually, and days over 32 degrees Celsius are expected to increase from 1.2 to 8.3. These conditions not only threaten public health, but also put pressure on city infrastructure and essential services. The Community Heat Response Plan outlines the actions to be taken when Environment and Climate Change Canada issues a heat alert, focusing on mitigating heat-related health risks, especially for vulnerable populations. As for immediate actions outlined in the report, the core focus of the response plan is the establishment and promotion of cooling centers. Upon a heat warning, the city opens designated cooling centers and ensures that all city-funded emergency shelters also serve as cool-down locations. With this being the central focus in the plan, citizens raised concerns about the accessibility of cooling centers. Kingston resident Tara Kaner spoke before the committee and raised concerns about potential barriers to accessing these centers, including transportation, limited hours of operation, and social stigma.
Cooling centers during heat waves are part of the solution, as studies suggest. However, there is little known about who uses them and whether they are effective in reducing heat illness and death. Obstacles to utilizing cooling centers are multiple. My request to you is that you take the time to consider the barriers before you endorse the Community Heat Response Plan. Please address the difficulties so that the cooling centers will be effective.
In response, the city's Manager of Climate Leadership, Julie Salter-Keene, noted that the plan will be subject to continuous updates, including looking into what data can be collected while preserving the privacy of those using the centers and offering more public transportation to make the centers more effective. In addition to cooling centers, the city will also be extending public pool hours during heat events, and continuing its Keep Cool While It's Hot campaign, which began in 2024 to educate residents about the risks associated with extreme heat and provide guidance on preventing and managing heat-related illnesses. Beyond immediate relief efforts, the Heat Response Plan also outlines longer-term strategies. These include strategic tree planting and green infrastructure to reduce urban heat, enhancing shade and thermal comfort in public areas like parks, playgrounds, schools, and the downtown core, and preparing for poor air quality during heat events, including clean air shelters and mask distribution. Looking ahead, community members also requested updates on progress on other items in the February motion to make the community more climate resilient. Salter Key noted that the proposed bylaw amendments required to set a maximum indoor temperature for rental units with AC will be reviewed by the policy committee in July. Extending the mandate to buildings that do not currently have air conditioning installed will be dependent on the findings of the City of Toronto, currently investigating the legal viability of applying such a bylaw to all residential units. This is expected to be complete by the end of the year. Councillor Wendy Steven wrapped up the discussion, noting the comments from residents and what's to come for the city in the next few months.
I just want to acknowledge Tara made some really good points that there are some actual legit barriers to people using cooling centers. And I think it's worth acknowledging that is definitely true. I think it's also important to acknowledge that the heat response plan is one piece of a bigger picture. I fully agree. It's not sufficient. It's not enough on its own. But I think that this is one piece that is a step in the right direction, at least in formalizing this. I completely agree. I think that the missing piece is going to be when we hear back about the City of Toronto. And I think that'll really put things in perspective of what we can and can't do so that we can hopefully move forward with some really meaningful action.
The Heat Response Plan will be reviewed annually in partnership with the Southeast Health Unit to ensure it remains effective and up to date. Residents can access current information on heat warnings, cooling center hours and locations, and signs of heat-related illness on the City of Kingston's website. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell coming in live from Richardson Memorial Stadium, catching the second of a three-game slate as the Kingston Grenadiers look to defend home turf against a litany of foes. The U14 squad played the North Halton Crimson Tide, and the U16 squad looks to improve their 3-1 record against the Brampton Bulldogs. It is a packed house here at Richardson, perhaps an effective test run for the upcoming Gales home opener on August 23rd. It's a beautiful day for some football, and the Grenadiers look to put on a show for their home crowd. After a bit of a slow start in the first quarter, both the Kingston Grenadiers and the Brampton Bulldogs put points on the board to end the first half, albeit in two very different ways. The Grenadiers preferred to ground and pound, relying on their star running back Declan Cowan, where the Brampton Bulldogs got it done largely via the passing game. At the end of the first half, the Grenadiers had a commanding 22-8 lead over the Brampton Bulldogs. After a scoreless third quarter that saw each team trade field position, the Grenadiers put the game away late with a 33-yard field goal from Griffin Fair, younger brother of former CFL kicker Campbell Fair. The U16 Grenadiers moved to 4-1 on the season, delighting the hometown Richardson crowd. If you're interested in more content from Richardson Stadium, head on over to at CFRC Power Plays on Instagram and check out CFRC at the Lang, a first-time partnership between CFRC and Queens Football, providing unprecedented access to the team, its players, and the incredible community members that make up the rich tapestry of Queens Football. From Richardson Stadium, this is Jesse Bell signing off.
Hi there, Kingston. I'm CFRC's arts coordinator, Ellie Sturton, and I want to share an upcoming arts initiative with you. This summer, the City of Kingston is inviting you to help shape the look of our downtown. As part of Kingston's public art program, the city called upon its artists to design a mural for the exterior of the Robert Bruce Memorial Parking Garage on Bagot Street. After a two-stage open call, 41 artists applied, and a selection panel of local artists and arts professionals reviewed every submission. From that pool, four Kingston-based finalists were chosen to develop a full mural proposal. And now, your feedback will help decide which design is selected. The artists and their designs are as follows. Aaron Forsyth brings us All in a Day with a colorful storybook-style mural celebrating the daily rhythms of downtown, from parks and pets to public transit and fresh market flowers. Abby Gowland designed Kingston in Motion, featuring bold, stylized figures biking, walking, and sharing a hug. It's a tribute to the vibrancy, diversity, and community that define the city. Frank Dessa proposed 1 through 10, which is a playful visual game of hand gestures counting from 1 to 10, set against a groovy setting sun. And Portia, or Poe Chapman's, Bloomin' Good Time is a pop art mural full of bright floral designs, which perfectly matches the flower baskets that flow throughout the downtown core. You can view all four proposals and vote online until Tuesday, June 19th at 4 p.m. Just head to Get Involved Kingston or call 613-546-0000 to share your thoughts. This is your chance to be a part of Kingston's creative scene and help choose the mural that will brighten Bagot Street for years to come.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, June 16th, daytime high of 23 degrees and a mix of sun and cloud dropping down to 16 overnight. Tuesday, June 17th, we're going to see a high of 25 and some cloud coverage coming in later in the day, which will lead to a 30% chance of precipitation overnight dropping down to 18 degrees. That rain will increase on Wednesday, June 18th, same high of 25, but a 60% chance of precipitation in the region, dropping back down to 18 overnight. Thursday, June 19th, we're going to see a daytime high of 23 degrees with some occasional morning rain with a thunderstorm mixed in, dropping down to 13 overnight. Friday, June 20th, nicer day here in the city of Kingston. Partly sunny, less humid, 20 degrees is the daytime high. Saturday, June 21st, just in time for Skeleton Park Arts Fest. Daytime high of 22 in a mix of sun and cloud. And that sun remains steady heading into June 22nd. That's the Sunday for Skeleton Park Arts Fest. Daytime high of 23, but it will be quite humid. Moving into the start of next week. Monday, June 23rd, daytime high of 25 degrees with a high likelihood of a strong afternoon thunder shower, so keep your eye out for that. And Tuesday, June 24th, going to see a decent amount of rain here in the city of Kingston with a daytime high of 24 degrees. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway's summer and fall closure schedule has been updated by Public Services and Procurement Canada. Reminder that the summer dates of the LaSalle Causeway's closure are as follows: June 22nd and 29th, July 1st, 6th, 13th, 20th, and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, and September 7th, the causeway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on each of those summer dates. As for the fall, the current dates are September 21st, October 5th, 14th and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th, the time of closure being 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on each of those dates. Here are this week's relevant road closures. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cassidy Street, Montreal to Maple is closed until June 20th as part of the ongoing intersection improvements of Montreal and John Counter. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Garrett Road, 6th concession to Sand Hill, is closed June 17th and 18th from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day for a culvert replacement. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria, is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street.
Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Here are some ongoing delays to be aware of. Abbeydon Road, middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Florida Road, Henderson to Wilton, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle. Expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Now coming up, we'll have a look at some great community events running in Kingston and the area this week. On Wednesday, get ready for a blast of 90s nostalgia at the Grad Club with Now That's What I Call Drag from 8:30 to 11 p.m. This themed drag show supports Trans Family Kingston and features a fabulous lineup of local performers. Wear your best 90s look for a chance to win the costume contest. On Thursday, bring the kids in a blanket to Stories in the Square at Springer Market Square from 10:30 to 11 a.m. It's a free morning of songs and stories for all ages. Later, Queerioki takes over Daft Brewing at 8 p.m. for a fun and inclusive night of karaoke hosted in a welcoming space for LGBTQ+ folks and allies. And at Springer Market Square in the evening, there's Movies in the Square, Pride Edition, starting at 8:30 p.m. with a screening of Heightened Scrutiny, a powerful documentary about trans rights and justice. On Friday, Theater Kingston is hosting its fourth annual fundraiser at the historic Edgewater House. The Garden and Emerald theme party kicks off at 7 p.m. with food, music, and dancing under the stars. Also on Friday, head to Carlow Estates Winery in Prince Edward County for bingo from 6 to 9 p.m., hosted by Rowena Way. And presented by Skeleton Park Arts Festival, the Walks of Life open mic takes place at Next Church from 7:30 to 9 p.m. All ages are welcome to perform or just enjoy the music, comedy, and poetry. On Saturday, celebrate National Indigenous Peoples Day in Confederation Park from 1 to 6 p.m. It's a free all-ages event with music, dance, and storytelling from artists including Takani, Allin Drum Circle, and Noel Miracle. At 2 p.m., Candace Weapon and Sadiqa DeMeyer lead a free poetry and performance workshop at Next Church called Page to Stage, Voicing Your Verses. Skeleton Park Arts Festival is also in full swing on Saturday in McBurney Park from 10 to 6 p.m. Skeleton Park Arts Festival is also in full swing on Saturday in McBurney Park from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Browse the Fat Goose Craft Fair, check out local vendors and community booths, and enjoy art making with the Department of Illumination. You can also see live mural painting by artist Aaron Forsyth. If you're in the mood for a comedic poetry show, Gem Rolls, Adventures in Canadian Parking Lots runs at the Tet Center at both 1 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. And on Sunday, Skeleton Park continues at McBurney Park with more crafts, food, art, and mural painting. Activities run from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and are open to everyone. If you're feeling brave, Ghosts and Good Boys Walking Tour departs downtown at 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. These $40 spooky tours benefit the Kingston Humane Society, and yes, dogs are welcome on the evening tour. Have a local event that you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca. Hey folks, it's Ellie Sturton, and coming up are your live music events happening around town this week. On Wednesday, musicians can join Buckle Blues Jam at The Buckle from 7 to 10 p.m. There's no cover and all are welcome to play. The RCHA features a blues showcase from 7 to 10 p.m. with Hendrika and Savannah Shea. Or swing by Timeout Bar and Bistro to hear Chris Strong from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. On Thursday, The Cove Inn is hosting Original Thursdays with Al Lerman from 5 to 8 p.m. He's a Juno-winning blues and roots artist and entries by donation with a suggested cover of $20. Over on Wolf Island, Open Season brings Hugh Christopher Brown, Joey Wright, and Jason Mercer together at Hotel Wolf Island from 7:45 to 9:45 p.m. for a genre-bending night of live music. At the Mansion, Pitch and Pour starts at 8 p.m. with performances by education students. That one is 19 plus with a small cover at the door. On Friday, start your weekend with Happy Hour TGIF at the RCHA from 4 to 6 p.m. featuring the Smokin' Roosters. Stick around afterwards for $5 dates at 8 p.m. playing crowd pleasers and classic covers for just $5. At Timeout Bar and Bistro, Riley Murrigan performs from 3 to 5 p.m. followed by Paula Wood from 6 to 8 p.m. Hotel Wolf Island hosts the Retro Kings at 8:30 p.m. for their new album release show. You can also check out the Food Bank fundraiser at Overtime Sports Bar starting at 8:30 p.m. with live music from several local bands. Entries by a $10 donation and all proceeds support the partners in mission. On Saturday, the Skeleton Park Arts Festival takes over McBurney Park from 7:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. This free all-ages event features yoga with live music, a kids show with splashin' boots, and performances by Anthea Fever, Zune, Trash Panda, Brass Band, and headliner Candace Weapon. Also on Saturday, the Creekside Music Festival runs from 2 to 8 p.m. at the Creekside Bar and Grill with live music all afternoon. At the Cove Inn, Young Petty Stones brings a tribute to Neil Young, Tom Petty, and the Rolling Stones from 7 to 11 p.m. The Broom Factory hosts a summer kickoff concert starting at 7:30 p.m., and Hotel Wolf Island presents Mike Guinney and Julia Finnegan also at 7:30 p.m. Folks can hear live music from Christopher Jackson at the Princess Street Promenade between noon and 4 p.m. Lynn Miles, Rebecca Campbell, and Keith Glass perform at Leopard Frog Barn from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m. And Mimi Obonsawin plays a free outdoor show at 9 p.m. at Sydenham and Princess, and DJ Cacao spins at Musiki from 8 to 11 p.m. There's also a fundraiser at Spearhead Brewery from 4 to 10 p.m. with live music, a silent auction, and a DJ set. On Sunday, Skeleton Park continues all day at McBurney Park with music, yoga, and a brass band parade. Sounding off on Queer Joy happens at Next Church at 2 p.m. with performances by Tiny Horse and Trash Panda Brass Band. Live Music Sundays at Finkel's Shore Park runs from 2 to 5 p.m. with Clem Chesterfield, Mellow Lily, and the Marion Drexler Band. Over at Hotel Wolf Island, jazz pop artist Tia Brazda performs on the patio from 3 to 6 p.m. You can also celebrate Pride at Compass Rose Suites starting at 7:30 p.m. with Latin dance music from DJ Linz and food from Jenny Bonsai. Have a local concert that you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage funky one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Hey Kingston families, looking for an unforgettable summer adventure for your kids? Look no further than ASSIS Camps right on Queen's University campus. ASSIS Camps offers English and French programming for children ages 4 to 12. Campers participate in crafts, games, experiments, field trips, and activities with special weekly guests. ASSIS staff ensures a safe, packed summer with memories that'll last a lifetime. Spots are filling up fast, so register now at assiscamps.ca.
Mondays can be a tough day, But would you like something to brighten up your Monday afternoon? Well, tune in to my show, Dark Glasses, on CFRC 101.9. My name's Daniel Wolf, and the show is now in its 14th year with a mixture of mainly jazz, but also blues, folk, some pop, even retro pop, and the occasional interview. So that's Dark Glasses, Mondays at 2 p.m.
Yeah, she's talking about making bacon with me, DJ Over Easy, Saturday mornings from 8 till 10.
You produce your own oil and allow others to taste and see that CFRC is good.
If you enjoy genres like slowcore, post-hardcore, noise rock, math rock, shoegaze, or anything like that, tune into Past Tense, 9 p.m. Wednesdays on CFRC. It also airs 9 p.m. Mondays on luradio.ca and 9 p.m. Thursdays on cjlo.com.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
In his first days in office, President Biden issued a presidential memorandum that specifically centered advancing the human rights of LGBTQI plus people in U.S. foreign policy and development assistance, as well as protecting the rights of LGBTQI plus migrants and refugees. I think it's clear that under the Trump administration, the U.S. is fully abdicating its global leadership on LGBTQI plus rights.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Czech trans woman beats forced sterilization law in Eurocourt. Young bi women fuel Australian queer population explosion. And USAID cuts devastate global queer community. Those stories and more this week now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Sarah Montague.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 14th, 2025. The Czech Republic sterilization prerequisite for a transgender or non-binary person seeking to change their legal gender has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights. The Strasbourg-based court ruled on June 12th that the mandate violates privacy guarantees in Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Plaintiff Taylor H. was assigned male at birth but identifies as female. She has fought for more than a decade for the right to change her legal gender and associated personal identification number. Taylor H. first challenged the sterilization requirement in 2012. The case went all the way to the Czech Constitutional Court in 2021, where she lost. The Eurocourt of Human Rights offered her a last opportunity to change the law. Meanwhile, the sterilization requirement was struck down by the Czech Constitutional Court last year in a separate case filed by a transgender man. The justices delayed enforcement of the ruling until July 1st of this year to give the government time to replace the law, but the legislature failed to act. Taylor H. called the decision a great day for non-binary and trans people. She said, "It's essential that Europe follows a path of dignity, equality, and human rights, especially amid global efforts to roll back trans rights."
The number of Australians over the age of 15 who openly identify as LGBT+ has mushroomed, according to a new university study. Researchers at the prestigious Charles Darwin University in the country's Northern Territory report that the number grew from 3.3% in 2012 to 5.8% in 2020. Young women who identify as bisexual were the biggest driver of growth over that eight-year period. Researcher Fiona Shalley noted that the increase mirrors the growing social acceptance of queer people, capped by the public vote approving marriage equality in 2017. The upcoming 2026 census will ask a question about sexual orientation for the first time. Those results will provide an even clearer picture of Australia's LGBTQ plus population.
The Southern Baptist Convention has come out in support of the repeal of marriage equality in the U.S. A huge majority of the more than 10,000 voting messengers at the denomination's annual meeting in Dallas, Texas, approved the collection of resolutions in a declaration called Restoring Moral Clarity Through God's Design for Gender, Marriage, and the Family. The June 10th declaration was the Baptists' way of commemorating the 10th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Obergefell marriage equality ruling. They call for the institution to be limited to one man and one woman. They believe that equality laws not only defy God's design for marriage and family, they also undermine what they think is the biological reality that there are only two genders. Moreover, they foster willful childlessness, gender confusion, and the undermining of parental rights. The resolution package also includes calls for bans on pornography and gambling on sports. The Southern Baptist Convention is the largest Protestant denomination in the United States. Delegates to this week's conference represented close to 50,000 churches and some 12.7 million members as of 2024. Their consistent opposition to marriage equality, of course, means that those churches do not solemnize same-gender relationships. President of the denomination's Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, Denny Burke, told the New York Times, "We know that we're in a minority in the culture right now, but we want to be a prophetic minority."
LGBTQ plus community, reflect on our journey and look ahead to the future as we kick off this World Pride Parade and recognize our 50 years of pride here in the nation's capital.
World Pride 2025 climaxed with a joyous June 7th parade and a defiant June 8th International March on Washington for Freedom in the U.S. Capitol. The three preceding weeks of events included parties, exhibitions, workshops, and a three-day human rights conference that attracted more than 800 activists. Hundreds of thousands of celebrants were drawn to the nearly six-hour parade, led by marchers carrying a 1,000-foot rainbow flag. The second of a two-day festival followed the parade, featuring hundreds of people staffing booths ranging from commercial ventures to non-profit organizations. Free concerts during the celebration featured Cynthia Erivo, Dochi, Khalid, David Archuleta, Christine W., Troy Sivan, RuPaul, Kim Petras, Jennifer Lopez, and Renee Rapp. Periodic rain failed to dampen the festivities. Then it was on to the Lincoln Memorial the following day. There were not as many international visitors attending World Pride this year, thanks to the anti-immigrant and anti-queer policies of the Trump administration. Those from the Global South were particularly impacted.
Tel Aviv's LGBTQ Pride was cancelled by the authorities on June 13th after Israel launched airstrikes against Iran. The festivities were scheduled to begin that day. A mass protest of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that had been scheduled for the following night was also cancelled amid concerns for security. Tel Aviv has hosted one of the region's largest Pride celebrations, and up to a quarter of a million people were expected this year. Highly controversial pro-Trump transgender celebrity Caitlyn Jenner was to have been the guest of honor. This was the second consecutive cancellation of Tel Aviv Pride. Last year's parade was called off by authorities and activists due to the ongoing hostage crisis and war in the Gaza Strip. Jerusalem's annual Pride parade took place without serious incident on June 5th.
Is Andre Jose Hernandez Romero still alive? 52 U.S. congressional Democrats have demanded proof of life for this renditioned 31-year-old Venezuelan makeup artist. Hernandez Romero had applied for asylum based on threats to his life for being gay in his homeland. Immigration officials detained him based on some of his tattoos in a sweep of alleged members of his country's notorious Trende Agawa gang. His defenders say the tattoos were not in any way gang-related. He is believed to be in the infamous maximum security CECOT prison in El Salvador. A June 9th letter to Secretary of State Marco Rubio was written by now Congress members Robert Garcia, Sarah McBride, Mark Tacano, Becca Balint, and Richie Torres. They asked for a wellness check on Mr. Hernandez Romero and for Secretary Rubio to facilitate his access to legal counsel and immediate release. Garcia told The Advocate, Pride Month is an opportunity to highlight his story even more. The more folks learn about it, the more they'll put pressure on the administration and Homeland Security to do the right thing. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has already directly rebuffed Garcia's request for intervention. There's no reason to believe that Secretary Rubio will respond any differently.
Finally, U.S. Air Force veteran Gina Ortiz Jones has become the first out LGBTQ candidate to be elected mayor of San Antonio, Texas. She defeated Trump acolyte and ally of anti-queer Republican Governor Greg Abbott, Rolando Pablos, in a runoff election on June 7th. Jones will become the third female mayor in the nation's seventh largest city. She previously served as Undersecretary of the Air Force during the Biden administration, where she managed a $173 billion budget and led 600,000 people. The victorious Filipino-American promised during her campaign to open early childhood education to more kids and to increase affordable housing and work programs for unskilled workers. Jones told supporters at a victory celebration,
"It was my name on the ballot, but you and I know decency was on the ballot. Kindness was on the ballot. Compassion was on the ballot. And San Antonio showed up and showed out."
Jones will be sworn in on June 18th for a four-year term. She honored one of her volunteers with a promised appointment.
"I want to highlight Brandon because Brandon is from San Antonio, transgender man, drill instructor in your United States Air Force, but unfortunately is getting kicked out because of the executive orders. I'm very proud of the fact that Brandon's going to stay in San Antonio. It's unfortunate that the United States Air Force is not going to benefit from your talents because of bigotry, but Brandon, we'll find a spot for you." Yeah.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 14th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Montague. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Hi, this is Sorgi Thor, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine heard on over 200 radio stations worldwide, the World Radio Network, and on the World Wide Web. Keep listening.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place. If you can, reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place.
When the Trump administration gutted the United States Agency for International Development LGBTQ plus people were robbed of more than 100 programs aimed at advancing their health, safety, and human rights around the world. Notoriously transphobic billionaire Elon Musk wielded the financial chainsaw for his personal goals as much as for President Donald Trump, who's been using his Sharpie to slash LGBTQ plus rights. A few days before the power couple's much-publicized romantic breakup, an impeccable source told This Way Out's David Hunt that the days of U.S. leadership on global queer rights are over.
On June 4th, 2025, the Trump administration asked the U.S. Congress to claw back $9.4 billion in spending that lawmakers had previously approved in the federal budget. Trump said that was the amount of waste, fraud, and abuse uncovered by his biggest campaign donor, Elon Musk, through the so-called Department of Government Efficiency. It's a far cry from the $2 trillion of wasteful spending Musk had promised to find. To keep the president happy, Musk has taken aim at some of Trump's favorite targets: PBS, NPR, and almost every dollar of foreign aid. I'm David Hunt. The government's efforts to dismantle USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, have been extensively documented in the media. The administration's termination of 5,341 foreign aid projects has disrupted global health programs and reduced access to education and health care for millions. Thousands have likely died as a direct result of the sudden cutoff of funding, according to Boston University. Less well documented has been the impact of the funding cuts on programs advancing the health, safety, and empowerment of LGBTQ people around the world. To explore that part of the story, I sat down with Ari Shaw, Senior Fellow and Director of International Programs at the Williams Institute.
The Williams Institute is a think tank based at UCLA School of Law, focused on LGBTQ law and policy. And our goal is to really ensure that evidence and data are brought to bear on policymaking and judicial decision making that impacts LGBTQ people. For so long, myths and stereotypes have been relied on, and unfortunately, to this day, still in many cases, to generate bad policy and bad laws that impact LGBTQ people.
In a brief published in January, shortly after Trump signed an executive order pausing all foreign aid, Shaw suggested the order was just the first step toward the Trump administration's broader goal of eliminating LGBTQ issues from U.S. foreign policy and development assistance. He was right. A 90-day pause in aid led to the cancellation of thousands of programs, including more than 100 serving LGBTQ people around the world. Among the cuts, $5 million to combat gender-based violence and anti-LGBTQ violence in Honduras, $1.3 million to promote social, economic, and political inclusion for LGBTQ people in North Macedonia, $4 million for a gay men's health initiative in South Africa, $10.5 million for international disaster assistance for organizations led by women, disabled, and LGBTQ people in 24 countries. Those cuts pale compared to the amount of funding pulled from HIV/AIDS programs. The Trump administration canceled $262 million for the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS and $238 million for the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. And it effectively ended President George W. Bush's signature foreign aid initiative, PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, first signed into law in 2003. The countries impacted include some of the poorest in the world, 18 African nations, including Uganda, Burundi, and South Sudan, India, Indonesia, and Nepal in Asia, Guatemala and Nicaragua in Central America, and the Caribbean nations of Jamaica and the Dominican Republic. The impact is, in the words of the New York Times, heartbreaking. Reporting from Kampala, Uganda, in March, New York Times reporter Abdi Latif Tahir said, "The rapid loss of aid from the United States has left many gay Ugandans terrified." He reported, "The conditions for LGBTQ Ugandans is so perilous that shelters often move locations frequently or relocate individuals in order to avoid personal attacks or raids from the authorities. Now, some of those shelters are beginning to close." The situation is much the same for LGBTQ people in other countries, in other parts of the world, according to Ari Shaw.
To this day, there are still more than 60 countries that criminalize consensual same-sex activity. I think something like 11 have the death penalty as one of the penalties for individuals who are convicted of under these criminal statutes. In many countries, being transgender or in some way kind of deviating from normative gender identities or gender expressions is criminalized as well.
The Williams Institute has played a key role in helping to advance human rights for LGBTQ people. Until funding was canceled by the Trump administration in January, the Institute participated in two USAID programs in the current fiscal year, a task force providing technical assistance to USAID programs seeking to serve marginalized populations, and the Global Human Rights Initiative, a broad-based effort to advance human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. Through his contacts at those programs, Shaw has seen the devastating impact of Trump's funding cuts.
I've certainly had conversations with groups around the world who have lost their funding, that have had to either close their doors entirely or lay off substantial numbers of staff and employees. And these are organizations, again, that are providing, in many cases, life-saving necessary care and services to the community, providing medical services or, you know, shelters for unhoused or other people in really dire circumstances whose lives are at risk now because they are not able to access these services. It's a really dire set of circumstances, and there's a lot of fear and precarity because it's not clear where additional funding would come from. In many cases, even just services that were already performed, that were contracted by the U.S. government through USAID, where organizations, they've already provided the services and are just supposed to be paid or reimbursed for those expenses. They haven't been able to receive those funds. So it really is a kind of life or death scenario for a number of organizations, and as a result, for individuals and communities that are dependent on those organizations for services.
You are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Ari Shaw, Senior Fellow and Director of International Programs at the Williams Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law. Foreign aid for LGBTQ programs is a relatively new endeavor. The Biden administration embraced inclusive development practices shortly after Joe Biden's inauguration in January 2021. USAID increased resources for LGBTQ programming from $6 million in 2021 to $25 million in 2024. At this level, USAID was the second largest global donor to activities supporting LGBTQ people in developing countries, Shaw says.
Under President Biden, LGBTI rights were really sort of elevated and centered as a priority within U.S. foreign policy and development assistance. In his first days in office, he issued a presidential memorandum that specifically centered advancing the human rights of LGBTQI plus people in U.S. foreign policy and development assistance, and called on federal agencies to ensure that they were taking steps to advance these rights, and kind of specifically called out issues around ending so-called conversion therapy practices, efforts to debunked efforts to change sexual orientation or gender identity, as well as protecting the rights of LGBTQI plus migrants and refugees, and sort of broadly decriminalizing consensual same-sex activity around the world.
What Trump and opponents of foreign aid don't appreciate is the importance of soft power to America's standing in the world and to the promotion of its interests.
By taking actions that, you know, support humanitarian assistance or global health or, you know, protecting the basic human rights of individuals around the world, the U.S. is able to be seen by local communities as a partner who supports fundamental freedoms, who supports sort of basic needs and services that comes to support local communities after a humanitarian disaster or other complex emergencies that require assistance. And, you know, at a very basic level, that helps people around the world see us as in a benevolent light, in a good light, right? As a strong, supportive partner and not as an adversary.
It's not just the cancellation of foreign aid that's created a crisis for aid recipients around the world. The sudden and chaotic nature of the funding cuts and the unsupported claims of waste, fraud, and abuse took many programs by surprise and left them and their clients struggling to survive.
When the U.S. government deploys that sort of rhetoric and policymaking, it reinforces the stigma and gives permission to leaders and groups that oppose LGBTQI+ rights to further drive that message and attacks on the community.
Is the damage to America's reputation and moral leadership permanent? It's too soon to tell, but reputations take far longer to build or rebuild than they do to dismantle.
I think it's clear that under the Trump administration, the U.S. is fully abdicating its global leadership on LGBTQI+ rights, you know, not only in terms of the pause or the elimination of foreign aid funding, but also, you know, we see it in the proposed reorganization of the State Department that has been coming out in recent weeks, where programming pertaining to human rights and the rule of law is either being eliminated or you know, drastically reduced. The Trump administration, I think unsurprisingly, has not appointed a special envoy for LGBTQI+ rights of their own. They've withdrawn from the UN Human Rights Council, which is an important body for assessing the human rights situation of various countries, including how they're treating LGBTQI+ people and communities. And, you know, this sort of general turn or affinity that the Trump administration seems to have for authoritarian leaders and systems is really kind of anathema to the kind of support for liberal democratic values, including minority protections or support for LGBTQI+ rights that we saw under the previous administration. So I think across the board, we're seeing the Trump administration make an about face in terms of how it's acting on the global stage and with regard to LGBTQI+ rights.
But the United States is not alone on the world stage. Other nations, perhaps allies, perhaps adversaries, may take America's place, exercising the soft power that once enabled the U.S. to lead with its heart, not just its muscle. I'd like to thank Ari Shaw for sharing his insights for this program. Shaw is a senior fellow and director of international programs at the Williams Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Sometimes I lose myself.
Thanks for
for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Michael Taylor Gray and Sarah Montague and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. Stephen Stills, Diana Ross with Ashford and Simpson and Control S performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WOOL Bellows Falls, Vermont, Free Radio Santa Cruz, California, CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast to Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca.